Good morning, Your Honors. Raymond DiCamillo for Amylin Pharmaceuticals and the members of its Board of Directors. Justice Holland, it is my pleasure to introduce to the Court this morning Robert Sachs from the law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell. Mr. Sachs will be presenting the argument on behalf of the Amylin defendants this morning.
You're welcome to the Court, Mr. Sachs.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Laddick from Byard on behalf of the Bank of New York Mellon Trust Company, N.A., in its capacity as an indentured trustee, and I rise to introduce Mr. James Gadsden of the Carter, Ledger, and Milburn firm, who is my co-counsel in this matter. I will be arguing the case, though.
Welcome to the Court.
Good morning, Justice Holland, members of the Court, Judge Slights. I'm Joel Friedlander on behalf of plaintiff appellant San Antonio Fire and Police Pension Fund. I'd like to introduce Mark Lubovich and his associate Amy Miller from Bernstein, Litowitz, Berger, and Grossman, LLP. Pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 16E, Mr. Lubovich and I will be dividing the argument. Mr. Lubovich will go first to address the relief sought respecting the indenture. That's count three of the complaint. I'll then address the duty of care claim, count one of the complaint. And as we advised the Court by letter yesterday, Amylin and Bank of America and other the bank lenders have mooted count two by granting a waiver as to the proxy put in the credit agreement. So we will not be pursuing count two.
Thank you. We understand. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start the clock here. It will show your total time, and it will be counting down. If you get to the yellow light, you've used up all of Mr. Friedlander's time, and you're into rebuttal.
May it please the Court. There are two reasons why the Court of Chancery's opinion as to count three should be reversed. First, the opinion created a standard for disabling proxy puts that departs from Delaware law because it allows a board of directors to thwart a shareholder proxy fight without a compelling justification. Second, the Chancery Court was mistaken in saying that no party put in the record evidence supporting the declaration sought. There is more than ample evidence in the record supporting the basis for the board's approval of the shareholder nominees. Before addressing the Court's errors, we'd like to put the basic facts of the case into context. Amylin is a biopharmaceutical company that never made a profit. In the beginning of 2009, it had more debt than cash and cash equivalents. Most of that debt was trading at a steep discount to par. Amylin has an advance notice bylaw for nominating directors. At the deadline of that bylaw, set by that bylaw, at the end of January, two shareholders independently nominated five-person slates to Amylin's 12-member board. Why did they nominate minority slates? Well, Eastbourne explained in a letter to the SEC that it, quote, has no option but to limit itself because of to a short slate because of the proxy puts. So there are 10 seats that are theoretically up, but it became immediately obvious to all that shareholders could not possibly choose a new majority of the board. And they could not vote for any of the insurgents' nominees. That's because accelerating the company's debt would be financially devastating. A Morgan Stanley analyst wrote a report immediately saying that electing a new majority would put pressure on the equity, likely wiping it out, would effectively transfer ownership of the company to the creditors. Lazard wrote a report predicting correctly that the insurgents would be forced to combine slates in order to avoid any possibility of triggering these proxy puts. Plaintiffs sued in late March to compel the board to approve the shareholder nominees and disable the puts. The board, in response, did not say that it could or would withhold approval of the nominees. Rather, after months of investigating the nominees' backgrounds, the board's basic criticism of these insurgents was that they, quote, collectively lack the experience and expertise necessary to maximize value. The incumbent board never contended that these insurgents were looters or felons or were otherwise disreputable. There was no controlling shareholder who could influence the vote.
Mr. Lubovich, I need you to clarify one thing for me at least. Is it your position that the proxy put is invalid on its face, irrespective of any fiduciary fault, if any there be, on the part of the directors?
As to the indenture, no, because there is an approval right. That's what we consider like a fiduciary act that saves the proxy put. However, we're appealing here because the Vice Chancellor's standard set below is so discretionary and it's so subjective that...
So the invalidity is, it's invalid as a fiduciary duty matter in this particular case?
Yes. But we're not seeking to invalidate the provision itself. Rather, the board's fiduciary duties should compel the board to approve these nominees in this case.
All right. Now, is it Does that mean that the breach of duty, if any there was, took place at the time that the indenture was approved by the board? Or the board approved the company entering into the indenture, or are we talking about at some later time?
Well, when this case began, we were suing the board for the way that they approved the indenture. We then learned, because the board represented, that it was essentially oblivious to the proxy puts in the indenture, and that will raise Mr. Friedlander's arguments about due care. But at this point, where the board agreed to approve, and the Court of Chancery found, as a matter of contract interpretation, that the board has the power to approve the nominees and thereby disable the threat of acceleration. So that power exists. That is, again, that saves the indenture proxy put from legal invalidation. The question now is the standard that the Chancery Court created for that approval something that protects shareholders and protects the shareholder franchise, or, as we contend, it provides too much discretion to the board to just withhold approval and essentially thwart a proxy fight?
And this all relates to the fact that you didn't actually get the declaratory judgment that you wanted.
That's correct. The court granted the declaration as to the board's power to approve. That should have been the end of it, but then the court created a standard which, again, we contend essentially invited or allowed the board to reverse its position. Where it had agreed to approve, it now has not approved and asks for affirmance of a standard that would allow it essentially to never approve. So what we had, Your Honors, is a proxy fight over the proper direction for Amlin's future. The board on April 2nd wrote, after we demanded immediate approval, because time matters in a proxy fight, the board publicly said that they will do what is in its control to accomplish a fair and transparent election. On April 13th, there was the settlement where they agreed to approve subject to a declaration as to their contractual power to do so.
Okay, so basically we're focusing, I mean, your argument is focusing on the approval of the dissident nominees as distinguished from approval of the indenture, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Right.
And your argument is that the standard for approval should be Blasius-based rather than the standard that was, in fact, adopted by the Vice Chancellor.
That's precisely right, Justice Jacobs.
Was that argued below?
The argument below, initially, we had a motion for summary judgment that was on file relating to the requirement to approve, the contractual ability to approve, and the requirement to approve, and if there was no ability to approve, invalidating the provision. What happened is, with the board's agreement, in a settlement agreement to approve, that issue didn't have to be presented to the court because they'd already agreed to approve. What the court did is establish the power to approve, but then reached out to create a standard that no one argued for. I mean, the Amlin board was not arguing that they should have this extra discretion to withhold approval. Court reached out for that issue, and as a result, notwithstanding our demands, the Amlin board to this day has not approved the two nominees who were elected to replace the chairman and the lead independent director on Amlin's board.
Right, and just to round out the argument and tell me if I have it, if I don't have it right, that since the standard for approval should have been Blasius, mm-hmm. had the court applied that standard, it could not have found that the approval was valid in this case.
The approval... Had the court found...
Well, it would have been required to find that there was no basis for approval in this case.
Yes, absolutely. With a compelling justification standard, shareholders could launch a proxy fight knowing that the approval and the disabling of a proxy put will come very promptly, essentially absent a compelling justification, like looters or four felons and a controlling shareholder. What happened here is the court didn't apply the compelling justification standard, so didn't hold that the board, of course, should be approving, and then created a standard that has actually created enhanced scrutiny on the board's decision to approve. So we say that's essentially a second wrong because it put on the board and the shareholders a burden to justify a decision which patently created a fair election. We say there should only be enhanced scrutiny if a board acts against the shareholder franchise, never if they're going to act to allow a fair election by a wide shareholder body.
Was there any alternative argument advanced by the board or on behalf of the board in terms of compelling justification?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think, I mean, as I recall, it's because there really wasn't a dispute about whether they would approve. They never said that there was any basis for them not to approve. So, and by the time we got to before Vice Chancellor Lamb, there was an agreement to approve that had been submitted. That locked in, it illuminated the cloud over the election, at least to the extent that the only remaining question was, are they empowered to do so, or as Bank of New York was arguing, as a matter of law, Bank of New York said that the contract prohibited them from approving anyone who they haven't nominated or who they actually support in an election. That was the only issue.
So the answer is there was no compelling justification argument advanced either directly or as an alternative?
At the time of trial, that's correct. In our summary judgment papers, which were filed and briefed before the agreement to approve, that was a basis on which we sought either the invalidation of the put or to compel the approval. And turning to the standard itself really briefly, the standard puts in the board's judgment whether the election of the insurgents is materially harmful. And under Delaware law, the board's judgment about whether election of insurgents is harmful to the company is just irrelevant. That's a decision that is allocated to the shareholders exclusively. As this court wrote in the MM Companies case, even a board that's acting in good faith and doesn't believe that their own replacement is in the best interest of the company, a majority of shareholders who are not dominated in any respect could view the matter differently from the board. In the Blazes case as well, the chancellor found that the board in good faith believed that the election of the insurgents would cause, quote, grave injury to the company. And even that was not a basis to undermine the vote. And here what you have is a standard set by the court below that allows, and as we believe we're seeing now, invites a court, a board, to undermine the shareholder franchise. They're withholding approval based on their own judgment. Again, below Amelin, it's argued at the trial that they hypothesized in an instance where they could withhold approval because they were asked. And they said, well, imagine four felons. Now, we think that you need four felons and a controlling shareholder, but that's the argument that Amelin made below, is if you had four felons, our fiduciary duties might allow us to withhold approval. That's very different from what we're seeing now.
Now, why is the issue ripe now? I mean, the vice chancellor said it should await subsequent litigation. What's wrong with that approach?
Well, the basis for the court's finding that it wasn't ripe was a mistake in the record. The court said that no party had put in place evidence showing the basis for the court's decision, for the board's decision to approve. And the court also inferred possible ulterior motive by saying, well, maybe they approved just to get rid of monetary damages. The issue was presented in full to the court, and the court simply missed it. There was no claim for monetary damages. We only sought to disable the proxy puts to allow the franchise to proceed. And there was no ulterior motive suggested, because Bank of New York, which had the incentive to develop a record on that, never did. They never suggested any other motive. And as far as the record goes, what we have are public statements by the board. We have the April 2nd letter, where the board said that they will do what's in its control to accomplish the goal of a fair election. And when they announced the settlement, the board also said that they agreed with our position. They said, as the litigation developed, they agreed with our position. And they said, it has always been the view of Amelin and its board that shareholders should have the right to make decisions on matters such as board composition. So the record was more than there. The criticism of these contestants was mild, to say the least, and clearly a matter for shareholders to decide.
And you're into the time you've reserved.
And if the court has no further questions, I'll save my rebuttal time.
May it please the court. Count one of the Fourth Amended complaint seeks a declaration that Amelin's directors breached their duty of care when they approved first the indenture in June 2007, later the credit agreement towards the end of 2007. The Court of Chancery entered judgment for the director defendants on count one, even though it was stipulated in the pretrial order that the directors were unaware of the proxy puts in the indenture and the credit agreement when they authorized those debt instruments. Indeed, Amelin's CEO and the CFO, they both testified that they did not become aware of the proxy puts until they read in the February 2nd, 2009 Morgan Stanley analyst report that if the two stockholder slates succeeded, the equity of Amlin would likely be wiped out by the acceleration of the debt. The Court of Chancery said that admission of the CEO and the CFO, quote, may seem compelling for its shock value, unquote, but, quote, does little, if anything, to support the due care claim. And the Court of Chancery was simply mistaken in believing that there was no record evidence that the CEO was a member of the pricing committee of the board that approved the indenture. And the Court of Chancery never addressed the credit agreement. In fact, the pricing committee minutes, which are in the record, showed that the CEO was a member of the pricing committee and attended the pertinent meetings when the indenture was approved. He also signed the unanimous written consent for the credit agreement. The CFO was the person responsible for describing the terms of the convertible notes to the members of the pricing committee. We respectfully submit that the admissions of ignorance by the directors, the CEO, and the CFO not only have shock value, they're dispositive for purposes of the due care claim.
Can I interrupt you there?
Sure.
Am I correct that the officers and directors were given assurances by their legal advisors that there was nothing, there were no unusual provisions buried in this document?
That's correct. There was evidence that an inquiry was made. Is there anything unusual or not customary in the agreement?
Okay, and would you agree that this is, at least so far, an unusual or not customary provision, so that it probably should have been disclosed?
Well, I wouldn't concede that so quickly. Indeed, the Amlin board says these provisions are ubiquitous, and we take issue with that. There have been dozens, if not hundreds, of these provisions submitted into the record, similar provisions. For the credit agreement, I think the Bank of America submitted 54 credit agreements. And you can argue about the adjectives. Is it common? Is it ubiquitous? Is it unusual? There was something about they identified about half of their peer companies had at least one security with a similar provision. But you know, the same could be said of a dead hand poison pill as of 1998. They're out there. But we've never, I don't think there's ever been any Delaware law that would say if something's customary or not unusual, that's enough. Indeed, the Court Chancery said that's not enough. And it doesn't provide the context for evaluating, does it make sense in these circumstances? A proxy put was invented in 1986 as an anti-takeover device. The first generation of proxy puts and poison debt, 1986 to 1988, are generally recognized in the literature as to defend against proxy contests and hostile takeovers. This Court's jurisprudence is based on allocating responsibility to the board to make an informed judgment about whether a given defensive measure satisfies UNICAL or satisfies BLASIUS if it reaches
okay,
that level.
But what I'm trying to get to is the argument you're making, in essence, is that directors must read every page of every document that they have to pass upon.
No, I respectfully disagree. There was no list of material terms supplied to the directors about the indenture. There was no term sheet given out to the board. They were not given a copy of the offering memo, which is, of course, a summary description with headings. That was not given out to the members of the committee. There was no inquiry. Please identify all the material terms. Are there any change of control provisions? What are the acceleration provisions? And I think something as fundamental as a change of control provision is something that directors are obliged to know about and inquire about.
Go ahead.
I was thinking of the Court's post-trial Disney opinion in 2006, where the Court went through this very extensive analysis of was the Ovitz severance payment, was adequate information provided to the compensation committee about the magnitude of that payment, and it was all this effort to go through it, was there adequate information provided? Would it be enough to just say, this employment agreement has customary terms?
Mr. Green,
without knowing if there was any severance, it's just inconsistent with the standard that this Court's laid out for material adequate information.
I just want to clarify the contours of the argument that you're actually making here. I gather you do not claim that the proxy put is invalid on its face. Is that correct?
We do not argue that the indenture is invalid on its face. We did make that argument as to the credit agreement.
All right. Are you arguing that at the time the board is asked to approve an indenture with the proxy put, that some standard, some intermediate standard, such as BLASIUS or UNICAL, applies? Is that your argument, or are we talking solely here about due care?
Well, if the board was informed and knew about it and knew they were putting this burden on the shareholder vote, I think then Blasius would apply. The reason why, and then here, the board's defense
but
is...
But you're saying we don't need even to get to that because the board, as you see, it was not informed.
Right from the beginning of this litigation, their admission, their defense was we had no idea this provision was in the contract.
Right. So we can, for purposes of your argument, the focus is on due care as the standard.
Correct.
And is it correct that your argument basically is that as a procedural matter, the court, either a procedural or a substantive matter, the court should not have granted judgment for the directors at this stage?
Well, as procedural, actually as a substantive matter, we were seeking a declaratory judgment, among other things, a declaration that the board breaches duty of care. The Court of Chancery entered judgment in favor of the defendant.
And it should have entered judgment in favor of the plaintiffs.
Correct. And that's that decision is out there, and we think it gets Delaware law wrong. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. Perhaps I can leave my time until then. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm uncertain why we're here on the issues relating to count three of this complaint. In count three of the complaint below, we prevailed and the plaintiffs prevailed on the only issue that was presented to the Chancery Court. This is an unusual situation where we and they had exactly the same position. We asserted a claim that we were entitled under the indenture, the directors were entitled to exercise their discretion to cleanse, if you will, or approve dissident nominees. The plaintiffs agreed with that. We agreed that if the court issued that determination, a declaration to that effect, that the board would cleanse these particular nominees for this particular election. We went to trial. We, hand in hand with the plaintiff on that particular claim, Bank of New York opposed that particular claim, and we prevailed, and the plaintiffs prevailed. So when the plaintiffs say that they didn't get the declaration they want, they got the declaration that they wanted and the declaration that they asked for. They got the declaration that adopted the standard that we asked the court to adopt, a standard involving fiduciary duty, and they got the standard that they asked the court to adopt, a standard involving fiduciary duty. There was nothing at all amiss, wrong, or misguided about the Chancery Court's decision on that point. And what the Chancery Court did as to whether it had before it the authority and information to adjudicate the actual decision by the board to agree to cleanse these nominees, while he offered an opinion that that was not evidence that was presented to the court, it wasn't presented because the court was never asked to do that. The court was simply asked to issue a declaration as to the authority of the board of directors to cleanse nominees and the standard applicable to that.
Is it not the case that what's at issue at this point is the standard? I mean, the argument that that's being made to us, counsel, is that the trial court should have used Blasius as the standard, committed error by not doing so. Was that argued below?
Actually, that was not only was that not argued below, Your Honor, but worse than that. First of all, Blasius is a standard for judicial review of a decision by a board, not a standard of conduct by the directors. It's the degree of deference that the court will or will not give to actions by a board. The standard of there was no issue involving that because there was no issue in this case as to a refusal by the board to act to cleanse these nominees. Those allegations which were in the first complaint were removed. There was just so it's clear, there was no argument in this case that went to trial that the board acted refusing to approve nominees, that it was acting for an entrenchment purpose, it was acting for any improper purpose. The only issue that went to trial was the contractual interpretation issue as to whether the provisions of the indenture gave the board the authority to approve dissident nominees in a situation where the board was recommending that the shareholders elect different people to the board.
So your argument then is that the Blasius claim is procedurally precluded?
Not only is it procedurally precluded, it's not even ever been made in this case, ever. Your Honor, the standard for governing director conduct that was argued below, it came up multiple times. First of all, while the plaintiff has argued that it's improper, there's summary judgment brief. The director's responsibility in deciding whether to approve any Eastbourne or Icon nominee is circumscribed only by their fiduciary duties to Amlin and its stockholders under Delaware law. That's precisely the standard that the court adopted below. We argued the same. It came up at oral argument. Vice Chancellor Lamb asked me what the standard was. I answered him saying it's the standard that governs any decision. Fiduciary duties of the board looking out for the interests of the stockholders and the corporation. Plaintiffs didn't disagree with that because that is the standard we were both arguing for in this particular case. And indeed, the standard that is set forth in the opinion on this subject not only adopts that, but makes perfectly clear that in exercising their fiduciary obligations, the directors have no obligation to look out for the counterparty to the contract. It is as pro-stockholder a standard as could conceivably have been adopted by the court without writing the clause out of the contract at all. And indeed, if the fiduciary duty standards were not applicable to directors' conduct, what standards would be applicable to directors' conduct?
If we accept your procedural point that it was not argued below and not raised below, we do have an interest of justice exception under Rule 8. Should that apply?
There's nothing being reviewed below. This was not a decision or refusal by the board to approve people. There is no question in this case. The questions being raised are academic matters for jurisprudence in a case where a board is vested with the discretion to approve dissident nominees and refuses to do so. This case doesn't present that question for the court.
Can I perhaps reword what you just said and see if I've understood you? Are you saying that all that's happened here is a decision saying that directors in the exercise of their fiduciary duty can approve a dissident slate where there is this kind of provision in an existing contract? Fine. And if the next case comes along and the board of directors say we're exercising our discretion and not approving, that at that point there would be nothing in the current state of the law, including this decision, that would in any way keep parties from saying, well, in making that decision, you have to be considering the stockholders' right to vote, and we're going to review a decision to deny it under the Blasius standard.
Correct. It wasn't for this court to decide whether to apply UNICAL, Blasius, or business judgment rule in looking at this, because there was no decision by the board to refuse to approve nominees that was put before the court to evaluate. There was no evidence presented on it. It was stipulated that this board was prepared to do it.
Moreover, the quote-unquote standard that the trial court announced was not a standard that precludes the use of Blasius review in the next case that comes along.
Correct. If you get a case where a board refuses to act and there's an allegation that they do it for an entrenchment motive or to thwart the shareholder vote, the rights of shareholders to vote, you could, in that case, under the facts of that case, apply Blasius, applies UNIT or UNICAL. Absolutely. Nothing in this case addresses that at all. Let me address very briefly, Your Honors, since I have limited time, the issue of the duty of care that's been raised in this particular case. Again, on this particular issue, I'm not sure why we are here today arguing this issue at all. No relief has been sought against the directors in this case. The duty of care, if you will, is a claim that was made by the plaintiff solely to give them a hook to argue invalidity of the particular clause under Delaware law. In this particular case, plaintiffs have stipulated that the credit agreement clause, claims relating to the validity of the credit agreement clause, are moot at this point in time. So whether the board did or didn't, and there was ample evidence before the court to conclude, as they did, that the board didn't breach their duty of care, but even if they had breached their duty of care, that's no longer a live issue in this particular controversy because nothing was being sought against the directors, only invalidity of the clause, and it's now agreed that that issue is moot because the credit agreement has waived that forever. As to the indenture, Mr. Lubavitch, I believe it was Mr. Lubavitch, acknowledged that plaintiffs are not seeking to invalidate any longer the provision in the indenture because it is a perfectly valid provision that gives the board the a change of control provision that gives the board the authority to cleanse. And in this case, they made very clear up front that if the court interpreted the provision to give effect to the right of the board to cleanse dissident nominees, they weren't seeking their duty to pursue a duty of care claim against the board. It had no purpose. And so if you look at their pretrial brief, which is in the record, it says as follows: solely for purposes of pursuing the duty of care claim, plaintiff assumes arguendo the 2007 indenture does not allow a board to disable a proxy put by approving a dissident slate of shareholder nominees in a proxy contest, and that the proxy put is not facially invalid under Delaware law.
You're losing me, counsel, at least. The trial court believe that there was a live, ripe issue regarding the due care of the directors, and it granted judgment for the directors. The claim was that the court should not have done that. It should have done the opposite. What is your response?
Okay, the response to that, Your Honor, is the court did exactly what it should have done on the substance of the issue. The court properly analyzed the issue of due care with the evidence before it in accordance with settled principles of Delaware law, including the standard for breach of the duty of due care, which is one of gross negligence, in accordance with the standards for governing director conduct, which includes the statutory right under Section 141E to rely upon expert advisors of the corporation, and evidence which established in this particular case which the court laid out extensively in this particular case, that the board carefully deliberated over. Again, these were not provisions relating to change of control provisions. These were loan agreements, indentures for borrowing money for the corporation, that the board carefully deliberated over whether to borrow money, in what form to borrow money, how to borrow money. They carefully deliberated over the selection of expert advisors and retained expert advisors. They received advice from expert advisors and advice from the officers of the company on the subject. They questioned their advisors. They obtained summaries of the material economic terms of the borrowing for them and questioned about that. They received advice having to do with the benefits of this transaction to the board, to the company.
But at the time, they did not know that there was a proxy put in the indenture agreement, and they weren't advised that under at least some configuration of economic conditions, the proxy put could operate deprive the shareholders of their ability to elect a different board.
Correct, Your Honor, but the result would be, as Justice Berger said, the rule that they're arguing for, the only way that they could have known that was there, given that they did inquire, they did receive advice from the people knowledgeable, would have been to read the entire indenture, which is not what boards do. It's not the standard of conduct for the board. And the only way that they would have known in the face of extensive deliberations and consideration of a loan agreement that there was in that document a provision which wasn't intended to, but could have, if triggered in a certain way, have had some indirect impact, arguably an indirect impact on the election of directors, the only way they could have known that would have been through themselves individually reading this, because they did make inquiry. They did make inquiry as to whether there were any unusual or not customary terms in this indenture after they had extensive discussions about this. Remember, the purpose for this particular clause was this particular agreements were borrowing money from the company.
I understand your argument. My last question is, in view of the trial court opinion and the alarm, if that be the right word, expressed by the court regarding the potential effect of these proxy puts, is the argument you're making today one that will be makeable in the future? For boards that are not advised about the potential effect of a proxy put?
I think it could put people on warning that boards should, in the exercise of due care, make inquiry at a, the trial court was very clear, or Vice Chancellor Ryan was very clear, that lawyers should bring these things to the attention of people, and better practice would have been for these to have been identified. But two, you could argue that having focused upon it in this way, that the potential impact of terms like this, which are not only in loan agreements, these things are found in joint venture agreements, they're found in many types of contracts under Delaware law, and on all states' laws, should be something that people should inquire into specifically in the future. But in this particular case, there would be no conceivable basis under the gross negligence standard for finding any breach of duty on the part of these directors.
Can I ask you a quick question on the standard of review? Because there appears to be some, at least perhaps, disagreement. The legal standard that is to be applied here appears to be in agreement, meaning both sides agree this is a duty of care claim, gross negligence is the standard, so that the legal standard that the Vice Chancellor applied really is not in controversy. Isn't really what's in dispute here the Vice Chancellor's factual findings and his application of a settled legal standard to those findings? And if that's the case, what is the standard of review?
Sure. The standard of review of this court is deference to the factual findings of the Vice Chancellor on the on these particular issues. And Mr. Friedlander mentioned something about Blasius being a standard by which a court should review the duty of care issue. That would not conceivably be the correct standard for a court to apply here, because there was no evidence that this was a clause that was adopted with the intention to have any impact on voting rights. Blasius is a standard of strict scrutiny in a situation where, even if in good faith somebody adopts a standard that will have an impact on voting rights, if the principal purpose of that is going to be to have an impact on voting rights, this case was not such a case. The proper standard is the ordinary business judgment review, and the ordinary review that a court gives to decisions by directors, and this court's review should be, again, an ordinary appellate review with deference to the factual findings of the court below.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've used up all of your time, so you won't have any rebuttal time.
May it please the court. Mr. Sachs is confused as to why we are here, so are we on behalf of the Bank of New York Mellon Trust Company. We join in the arguments made by Amelin on the court's interpretation of the indenture, and I'm not going to sit here and repeat Mr. Sachs's fine presentation to you, but I did want to make one comment about what I think is an odd procedural posture here in this case that was created by the plaintiff's decision to appeal a lower court decision in which they are largely successful. It is true that Bank of New York now is left in the position where it's defending on appeal a matter in which it lost below. This is the standard articulated by the Vice Chancellor, in his opinion, was not what Bank of New York articulated below or believed should be the case. That being said, the reason why we're defending that decision is because the interpretation proffered by the plaintiff now would render that entire clause illusory, and it's the Bank of New York's position that it must maintain the rights that the note holders have under that indenture, and so that's why we are in this position now. But the fact that the other important part is that the company is not appealing this decision, and the fact that the company is not appealing the decision leads me to my first point, which is the standing of the plaintiff to make this claim or make this appeal at all. This is a contract between the company and the Bank of New York as the indentured trustee. The stockholders do not have directly enforceable rights under this contract, and the indenture specifically states that there are no third-party beneficiaries. The company sought relief. The company obtained the exact relief that it sought, and it's not appealing. Well, then how then does the plaintiff here have the right to pursue this appeal where it also received the declaration it sought? And now the plaintiff's only response is that this is an issue of voting rights and that the plaintiff's stockholders always have the right to appeal a voting rights case, but it's not really that simple. There are many things that could potentially infringe on voting rights. And we don't have to draw a strict line here, but we simply have to decide that where a company obtains a declaration, that the board has the power to waive a condition that might interfere with voting rights unless doing so would violate its own fiduciary obligations, that the stockholders should not have the opportunity or the power to challenge that interpretation independently of the company's own position. Now, the plaintiff's response to that argument is that this interpretation could cause harm in the future, but that response leads to our second issue that I would like to address, and that is the ripeness of this claim. The Bank of New York has taken the position throughout this litigation that the majority of claims asserted against the Bank of New York were simply not ripe for a decision at this time. The plaintiff's consistent approach here, it seems, has been to seek an academic ruling from the Delaware courts on its own theory of proxy puts. And Mr. Sachs addressed this issue slightly, and I want to go into it a little bit further. If you look at the joint pretrial order that was submitted by the parties, and it is in the appendix at A583 and A584, the plaintiff sought in paragraph 4 an order declaring that the Board of Directors of Amlin possesses the sole right and power under the terms of the 2007 indenture to approve any nominees proposed by Icon or Eastbourne in order to nullify the proxy put, or in the alternative that the continuing director's provision in the 2007 indenture is invalid, unenforceable, and severable. That's exactly the declaration that they got. That if you refer to the vice chancellor's opinion, that's exactly what he said. And anything beyond that simply is not right for decision at that point. Because what the vice chancellor told us is based on the language of the contract is only when a board may not approve a dissident slate. But what plaintiff wants us here now is really an advisory opinion on when a board must approve dissident nominees. And that decision, we respectfully submit, cannot be made without context. And here, the facts simply do not exist in this case. The plaintiff did not seek a declaration that the approval in the partial settlement by Amlin was valid, and did not seek a declaration that in the future any approval pursuant to that right would be valid. And there was, by the time the vice chancellor issued his decision, there was nothing that was going to trigger the proxy puts because the insurgent slates had reduced the insurgent stockholders had reduced their slates below the trigger levels. And so there was no record before the court in order to make a decision that the actual exercise of the power as opposed to the interpretation of the power was valid. And there's no evidence on the deliberations or motivations of the board. And it was proper for the vice chancellor to conclude that there might be something wrong with it because the partial settlement itself says that in exchange for the Amlin director's agreement to approve the insurgent slate, the plaintiffs had agreed not to seek monetary damages against the directors. And so the only evidence and inference from the evidence that was before the court is that the plaintiff had agreed not to seek money damages from the board in exchange for this deal. And based on those facts, we believe it was proper for the vice chancellor to say, hey, let's hold up. I don't have an actual claim before me to validate the approval, and I don't have the evidence before me to even consider the action. And so, and therefore, I'm not going to decide that. If you want to bring that claim later, we can do it when we have a full record and I have something actually before me.
Do you agree that nothing in the decision of the Court of Chancery precludes Blasius review in the next case, should there be one?
Yes, I do. I agree with Mr. Sachs's interpretation or argument on that point, that this was merely a standard of conduct and not, it was not establishing a standard of review for that decision whenever it gets made.
So it's your view that the Court of Chancery was asked if the board could give its approval and it answered that legal question in the abstract, but that it was never asked whether this particular approval was proper, and it, on the facts of this case, just said it wasn't right.
That's correct. If the court has no further questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's nothing academic about this appeal. Sitting here today, Amlin shareholders don't know if they can run a proxy fight, how many people they can run a proxy fight for, and if they do, whether there's any chance the Amlin board will actually approve and disable the threat of these proxy puts. We had a full trial here. We're approaching the court because the Chancery Court did not grant what we requested. Mr. Lady just read our request, and our request was for a declaration that the board has the power and the right to approve the Eastbourne and Icon nominees in that election. That election took place, and there was never an approval, and there's no approval today. And in fact, the Amlin.
Can I ask you a question about that? You have a settlement agreement, as I understand it, where the board has committed that upon receiving a declaration that it's entitled to approve, it will approve. Mm-hmm. That is now a matter of agreement. I hear you saying that they haven't done what they agreed to do in that agreement. Isn't that something that you could compel them to do?
Not under the existing standard. There's no appeal from the declaration that actually triggers the board's right to approve. I don't know why they haven't approved, other than we demanded and they refused, but the standard that the court put in place actually puts a burden on the board to prove and justify its decision, one that's allowed by the contract, one that's patently in the interest of the shareholders. And so that might be why they're not approving, because the standard actually subjects even good faith. We question whether the Amlin board actually wants to approve anyone here. They don't. But even a board that wants to allow the franchise to go forward is subject to judicial questioning. Theoretically, even this board has to justify its decision to approve. That's why we're appealing. The standard does not protect the shareholders, and it's not what the Amlin board sought. Their cross-claim that they filed against Bank of New York said that there's no restriction on their ability to approve other than that it has to be before the election. Now, the standard caused the board, to change its position. They no longer think that they have to have this done before the election because we're long past the election. They said it in paragraphs 9 and 22 of the cross-claim. And fundamentally, the reason why shareholders, in order for them to run proxy fights, they need to know that this issue gets resolved. Otherwise, they just won't run proxy fights. I mean, we see nationwide calls to improve proxy access. The court's rule, the Chancery Court standard, actually inhibits shareholders' access to proxy. Former SEC Chairman Harvey Pitt testified for the plaintiffs in this case, and he said, the problem with this provision is it inhibits shareholders from starting a contest because that will put the company down the road to accelerating its debt. He says the whole goal of a provision like this is to create a potential threat so extreme that people are not willing to invest the resources to figure out what's going to be with the proxy puts. The Vice Chancellor standard allows a board the benefit, the entrenching benefit of uncertainty over whether they ever have to approve. We always allege the conflict. In our summary judgment brief, we said the Amlin board suffers from a conflict of interest in seeking a determination whether the proxy put in the 2007 indenture can be disabled or is invalid. We said just as the DeSoto board suffered from a disabling conflict, that's the Sutton versus DeSoto case, which factually is the most on point, we think, because it dealt with continuing directors provision. And in that case, the court had absolutely no problem just assuming that the approval, the cleansing, you might say, was forthcoming and required by fiduciary duties. The court just assumed it, which gets to the standing point. The court also said that the shareholders obviously have the standing to pursue claims to get any contractual interpretation of that continuing director's provision. That's because the board is conflicted. Chancellor Allen found that easily. Here, a board is conflicted. They don't want. It's not in their personal interest to make it easier for anyone to take away their jobs. But what's more important on the standing is there's no standing question about third-party beneficiaries. We did win on the contractual power. We just don't have the order that gives the board the right and the obligation, which would trigger the settlement agreement. But we won on the contractual power. There's no appeal. So there's no basis to say that we're not third-party beneficiaries of a claim that we already litigated with the court's permission and won on. So there's no standing problem at all, and if there was, there's a direct conflict there. This court has, in the CA case and MM companies, back to Carney versus Holder, has always said that the paramount concern of Delaware is to protect the right to remove directors. The standard here allows the board to frustrate any chance of a vote. And because the January 2009 deadline is coming up to nominate new directors, it is a manifest injustice to remand, to force us to provide the same evidence we've already provided that satisfies the standard in order to prove an obligation to approve where our issue is the standard itself has invited the board to abandon its commitment to approve. And further proceedings are not necessary and will only hurt MLN shareholders.
Thank you.
Okay. On the question of the duty of care, the Vice Chancellor made no factual findings. Our case is based on admissions. The only thing factual the Court of Chancery said was a mistake where he thought that the CEO was not a member of the pricing committee, even though we'd supplied evidence that he was a member of the pricing committee and was nonetheless ignorant of the proxy puts. The problem is that the Vice Chancellor did not apply the standard that you need to have all material information to make a decision, and that's the standard laid down by this Court on numerous occasions. Instead, the Court recognized what it called the particularly troubling reality that corporations and their counsel routinely negotiate contract terms that may, in some circumstances, impinge on the free exercise of the franchise. And in the face of that troubling reality, the Court of Chancery was reduced to the empty exhortation to counsel to tell their directors about change of control provisions, when really, under Delaware law, it's the director's obligation to know the material facts. The counsel, under this opinion, if it allows to stand, counsel will know that despite that exhortation, if they don't tell directors about these provisions, the directors get off scot-free, not just for monetary liability, but for purposes of any declaratory or injunctive relief, because there's no underlying breach. And that's the fundamental flaw in the Court of Chancery's analysis, not imposing a fiduciary duty on the directors to obtain this information so that the counsel then knows they have to give it to them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. The Court found them very helpful. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll take a brief recess.